Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Day one of the Bizarro Ghost Convention here in Milwaukee. I'm actually in Milwaukee, and it feels so bizarre to have a convention in my hometown, sort of a non-convention, that I'm not actually going to go there. There's going to be no beer-soaked tailgate parties or receptions or anything. We're just all going to sit in our basements, and we're going to watch this streaming online, I guess. So we're kicking off a couple of weeks of, I think, pretty extraordinary convention coverage. So we're going to bring in an all-star team, and we're going to start off by no less than Mark McKinnon and Chris Matthews, guys who've been around a few conventions. So hey, thanks for joining me. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Okay, now
Chris, I think I've been to every convention since 64, and I missed one in 68, the one I really wanted to go to in Chicago.
I was there. But
every once in 64, I was a busboy in Ocean City, New Jersey back in 64, and I snuck into the convention. And the Republicans, ever since, I guess, 88, I've been to everyone since New Orleans. Yeah.
Well, I was at 68, so I can give you some notes on that, which is really weird, by the way. So I wrote in my newsletter, it's 52 years ago, and I can't remember what I did last week. I don't know about you guys. I'm going through the pictures of the Wisconsin delegation, running my finger over the faces. I can remember them all. I can name them from 52. Yeah. This was when I was like, 13 years old. So before we get started, so Mark, you were in the hospital like last week. Are you okay? What did you do to yourself?
Oh, I tried to see if my mountain bike could fly, and it turns out it can't.
Amazing.
Broke four ribs, punctured a lung, separated a shoulder, and I've got tingling in my legs that are a little bit numb. So, but listen, I'm healing up fast, and I was able to do the show last week, and that was the thing I was worried about. But the show must go on, and the show did go on, and we debuted our season premiere last night. So it's all systems go.
Well, I will admit I was amazed by that, because I saw pictures of you in the hospital, and the way you described it, it sounds pretty bad. You looked worse.
Yeah. It was bad. The good news is it wasn't a lot worse. It could have killed me or left me in a wheelchair. I was really kind of
that is the good news. Okay, so gentlemen, here we're at with this convention, and that nobody knows what it's going to do, who's going to watch. I have no idea. So you want to start off, Mark? Like, what the hell are we going to see, and will it actually make a difference?
Yeah, we're in no man's land here, because it's never happened before. I had a lot of responsibility for the conventions in 2000 and 2004, and we had a lot of conversations back then, almost 20 years ago, about just how anachronistic these things are. There's so much that happens over, whether it's 3 or 5 days, but it's this rolling party for insiders with lots of bad speeches from people that people don't care about, and horrible entertainment, especially on the Republican side. And so I'm surprised that it hasn't changed more before now. But I think now the sort of changes that are being made are changes that are long overdue. And I suspect that after this next week, we'll say, one of the few upsides of the coronavirus is that it put the conventional conventions out of our misery. And I think they'll be different from now on.
Okay, so Chris Matthews, I guess I'd fall into the category of I'm one of those who sort of bitched and moaned about how they had become, overstuffed infomercials. But I have to admit, I'm feeling a little nostalgic for this, because I mean, there's a long history of where stuff used to happen at these things, and this does feel like the kind of the end of an era.
Yeah, and what the Democratic conventions were distinctive, because the person who gave the best speech, and there's always one great speech, thank God, was never given by the candidate. Yeah. It was Mario Cuomo, of course, in San Francisco. It was Jesse Jackson in 88 down in Atlanta, who gave us a great speech. And there was, of course, Ted Kennedy in 1980, who had everyone go. So I do look forward to that. Kasich tonight, I think he has to give a good one. And I expect Bernie Sanders, who has been very conciliatory in terms of the nomination to Biden, his friend Biden, I think we're going to get a couple of big headlines tonight, probably Kasich and Bernie, because Bernie Sanders has really decided his fight will be over the platform and the agenda, not over the candidates. He's totally supportive of Biden. I think there's a real coming together in this Democratic world. I think surprisingly conciliatory, with Elizabeth Warren supporting, very much supporting Biden. Everybody seems to have gotten aroused a bit, excited by the Kamala Harris announcement. I think it's surprisingly, I don't think Democrats in disarray, that old alliteration is going to work this year. I think it's going to be solid because it's all about two out of the three voters is getting rid of Trump.
I want to pick up on that point. I think Michelle Obama is going to be the star of the night. And I was trying to think of who the Republicans.
I'm sorry. Of course she will be.
Yeah. I mean, she's going to be the person that we're all going to be talking about. But you make an interesting point. And, you know, as I was thinking about the 1968 convention, how different this convention is, leave aside the virtual convention. I cannot remember, Mark, maybe you can help me with this. This seems weird how united the Democrats are. Now, maybe it's a surface unity that will break apart after this election. There's obviously some tensions there. But this is really, in so many ways, the anti-68 convention in terms of Democratic unity.
You know, Chris, you've both been going to him longer than I have, but since I've been going to him, by far, this is the most united I can remember the Democratic Party. I mean, just by its nature, it's usually divided. And it's come together, even before the convention, even after the primaries, it consolidated pretty quickly. And I think to Chris's point, this is just a manifestation of how badly the people in the Democratic Party want to beat Trump. And speaking of speeches, I just wanted to mention, because I worked for Ann Richards, I just remember that 1988 speech in Atlanta that sent her off like a rocket. And so to the point is, we'll be watching this week to see who some of the next superstars are going to be.
Yeah, I remember the great line. Poor George, he was born with a silver foot in his mouth.
Yeah, that was it.
You remember those lines.
Oh, boy, do I.
Well, and of course, you know, Barack Obama was, you know, launched as a national figure by his part, you know, but you mentioned also, Chris, that there were so many bad speeches. And this is the thing is you have to, at least with the normal conventions, you can dip in and out and you could, you know, listen to some people. I mean, I remember being on the floor of the convention a couple of times where somebody was speaking and literally you couldn't hear her. I don't know whether you could hear him or not. Nobody was paying any attention whatsoever.
I know.
And then they would ask afterwards, how did that go? Well, you weren't on television and no one was listening, but was it worth it? Whatever price you had to pay. So Mark, on the convention, how do you look at the state of the play right now? Because in terms of white knuckle polling, that's a phrase I'm using in my newsletter, you have a CNN poll showing the race dramatically tightening only 4 points, but then you have the Washington Post ABC poll showing still double digits. What is your sense of where we're at right now, both the national polls, which don't really matter, and the swing state polls that you're paying attention to?
Well, you know, I mean, we always get distracted by the poll of the day. And of course, the CNN one's the big one. And it's the irony here is that the Trump campaign, which hates CNN, is now printing millions of copies, airdropping them over the country.
I believe it.
Right. But that, I mean, the thing we have to always do is take a step back. And the thing that is striking to me is is how consistent really and persistent the polling has been, which is you take it back to even last year of November or December until now, the average nationally is about 9 and the average in the battleground states is about 7. That's very consistent over time and, you know, is encouraging, of course, for the Biden campaign. But you know, we also remember that Michael Dukakis was 15 points up, you know, at his convention. I was wondering about the convention bounce, and I wonder what you think about this. My suspicion is that it's not going to be as big a deal at this convention because both Trump and Biden are just such known quantities. It's not like they're going to appear on stage and even George Bush in 2000, of course, Republicans knew him, but that was a big moment for the rest of the country to get a sense of who he was. I think people sort of know Biden and know Trump, so I'm not sure how much upside there'll be.
I think one thing, Charlie, is that Biden's advantage now is in the numbers, but that's his disadvantage because those numbers are going to, by nature of gravity, are going to come down. And so sometime in October, I think the story is going to be Trump catching up. He's the underdog. He's only down by 5 in most of the polls, or maybe less. And that's going to be, and then all of a sudden, the press that isn't particularly pro-Trump is going to start rooting for the horse race because that's what they do. Mm-hmm. And they're going to be rooting for the chance for a really close election so that Pennsylvania can go for Trump, Wisconsin for Trump. I mean, things can happen. And of course, against this background of intimidation about how you can't trust the post office and your votes aren't going to get counted, and there's going to be cheating. Everything that Trump does to his opponent, he's now doing to the voter, which is to intimidate them and get the voter off his and her game so that they're nervous about their process itself. I think Trump is really good at this. It's sick, if you might argue, but it's very effective. Get the guy you're fighting with, in this case, the voter, off their game so they're not really sure what they're doing. Look what happened to Marco Rubio. He was left spinning, and Jeb Bush left there looking foolish. I think he's trying to get the voter to feel that way. And if this gets close, which I think it will within 4 or 5 in the weeks before, the voter's going to get nervous. Are we going to get a good count? What's going to happen? Should I bother to vote? I mean, I don't know. I think this could be a very, very stressful time.
It's going to be an amazingly stressful time. We have 78 days to vote. So you guys are probably right. Let me give you a slightly contrarian take on all of this. And I don't think that there's going to be a huge bounce because I don't know what the audience is going to be for this. And of course, it could be a complete, you know, shambolic mess. But in terms of the conventions, Donald Trump had been hoping so desperately for the big convention because this is the show. This is the big show with the balloon drop and the big speeches and the crowds. He's not going to get that. He will give a decent speech because he'll read it off a teleprompter that will not be crazy. Okay, it's because that's what he does. But you know, let's face it, America knows Donald Trump. And, you know, we think that everybody knows Joe Biden. But, you know, the Republicans have done him a favor by spending hundreds of millions of dollars convincing people that he's senile, right? That he's going to get up there and he's going to drool and he's going to do a Grandpa Simpson routine, you know, yelling at the clouds or something like that, right? You know, if he gets up and introduces himself again to America as a reasonably coherent man with a vision, I think he can do himself a lot of good. See, I think guys like us, we have been following this so closely. There might be a sliver of the electorate that for the first time is going to be, you know, cued into this and clued into this. And we'll see the Joe Biden, not the Joe Biden that the Republicans have been putting on Facebook ads, you know, blithering, but a pretty compelling figure. So I do think there's an upside for Biden that I don't see for Trump. But tell me why I'm wrong.
I think it's a really good point, Charlie. And one thing about Biden is that there's a part of him, that empathetic part, that vulnerability, that the whole Bo story is such a powerful story that I think there is an opportunity there. But this, I'd say this is especially true. I know we're talking about the convention, but the Trump campaign has lowered the bar so far for Biden for the debates. All he's got to do is walk on the stage and complete a sentence, and he's golden. They have done themselves no service by pushing the senility message, because you're right, he's going to do what great at the convention. He's got a powerful story. And then when he goes to the debates, the expectations game is in his favor.
You know, even people that reasonable right, like the Wall Street Journal editorial page and Peggy Noonan, they both in the paper this weekend talk about him being confused, a lot, losing acuity. Look, I think that is right, lowering the bar. But I think what Trump will do is I think Trump will come on that stage the first debate, for example, when he's still down in the polls, way down, as a wounded lion. And he's going to be dangerous because he'll be biting and he'll be snarling and he'll say, Hunter. He'll say, Hunter, 3 or 4 times. He'll say, China, 3 or 4 times. He'll combine Hunter with China and coronavirus and blame this disease that has hit this country, this plague, on Hunter. Now, you may think that's crazy.
Yes.
But it sounds like Donald Trump to me.
And why do you think that could possibly work? Okay, but does that actually work? And
if Biden goes whack, if Biden goes crazy,
well,
gets emotional.
Well, right. And that, of course, is a risk. This is, by the way, has been my main concern is that Donald Trump and with his reptilian cunning knows, you know, what is your opponent's vulnerable point.
Exactly.
And going after, you know, a child is obviously a vulnerable point. But I wish I had Livia Nuzzi's piece in front of me right now, because she's talking about the, you know, what it will take to get Donald Trump back into this race, including, you know, a lot of these weird conspiracy theories. But I guess the question is, does this work? And I'm going to use her term, does rat fucking the Postal Service actually work for Donald Trump at this point? Yes, it makes voters nervous, but it also pisses them off, doesn't it?
Charlie, I think this may be the biggest strategic backfire of the campaign. You know, people criticize the post office, but they love the post office. This is,
yeah,
of all the government institutions out there, it has the highest favorability rating, 90%. And this is going after, I mean, rural people, veterans, people who rely on the post office. I think it's backfiring big time. And it's backfiring in a couple of ways. One is that, first of all, this is going to be a big story for a couple of weeks. And it sends the message that Trump said out loud, which he's afraid that Democrats are actually going to vote. And I also think that this is going to turn out to be the biggest get out the vote motivator maybe that we've ever seen for Democrats.
Yeah. By the way, who doesn't like their postmen? We all love those guys that come by in the short pants and any weather. And they always come by and say hello and they give you your mail.
And we're really reliant on them right now.
Yeah, I know.
You know? I know the Social Security checks aren't mailed anymore, so that's not true. Some of these stories have been exaggerated. But these stories you're getting about prescription drugs being delayed, other things being delayed, this is real-world consequence. And I'm struggling to find the upside for Trump. Now, you're saying, Chris, that he's rattling the voters.
That's what I think he's doing.
But it's one thing to rattle your opponent. It's another thing to rattle the electorate.
Well, I think he's trying to rattle opponents. I do think about our tendency to be procrastinators. I would think a lot of people are going to vote just in time to get their postmark in. And so they'll vote election day, I think. So that means that a decent percentage of voters in the close states like Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, will have votes coming in. A letter takes 2 or 3 days. Sometimes 2 days, sometimes 3 days. So we'll be getting our votes in on Friday. Is that going to hold up a 270 vote, guys? Is there not going to be a 270 when NBC and MS and CNN, everybody announces? Will there be a midnight 270 where somebody wins? Or will it be the usual too early to call?
Yeah, Mark.
I think almost unquestionably we will not have a decision election night. I mean, our show, which was intended to come back for the conventions. We were originally going to come back 2 weeks before the convention. We said, you know what, let's take those 2 weeks and put them after the election because we think there's going to be a lot to cover then.
Yeah, a lot.
No, I agree with you. I think that let 2 weeks, and maybe that's optimistic that it's just going to be, this is going to be 2 weeks, but you mentioned procrastination. I'm a procrastinator. Okay. So I'm the guy that raises their hand. I'm the guy that up until very recently would always go and vote on election day. One of the earlier election here in Wisconsin, I mailed it, I think the day before the election or something like that. I'm not going to do that this time. If I vote early, I'm going to take my ballot down to City Hall and I'm going to deliver it. So I wonder whether or not in terms of the backfiring, because we're talking about this in August, that people are really now focused on what does it take to turn out the vote? What does it take to make sure that my vote is not counted? I actually find myself really kind of nervous about, I do not want to be disenfranchised from this election. I mean, what do I have to do to make sure it's counted? If I have to stand in line for 4 hours, I will stand in line for 4 hours, but I'm going to try to vote early. So I'm just not sure how this plays out. So your reaction to Nancy Pelosi giving into pressure and bringing the House of Representatives back?
Well, I think she's, a lot of what, I'm not sure about her lately. I mean, I think she's done a lot of the, once you get into a fight, it's the fight. This is life. It's not the issues, it's the fight. And Trump likes to get people in the fight because he can make it, he's always better in the fight than his opponents when it just comes down to punching each other in the face. And when he got her to refer to him as morbidly obese, I thought he had gotten her where he wanted. It's a funny line, but he got her where he wanted her. It's where he gets his opponents and he gets them reactive. And is she going to settle for $2 trillion? I get the feeling that he's the only one that really likes a fight, really likes it. And then she will act like that too. But I'm not sure about this, what she's up to. Honestly, I'm not sure what she's up to today.
See, I thought this was the move that she had to make, which is the Democrats cannot sit back on this, that they've been handed this golden issue and they're seizing on it, Mark.
That's what I think. I mean, I think it's actually a great strategic move to make it clear that Democrats care enough about the ability for people to vote that they're going to come back from their vacations or being on the trail to make sure that that people have the franchise. And I think it's a great move for Democrats. I think it'll be received well. I think it's all upside, really.
Do they get a signature? Don't they need a signature on anything for the president?
Well, whether or not they get any signature on anything, I don't think really matters. It's just the fact they're making the effort that
yeah, you're right. You're right.
But do they come up with a coronavirus package though? I mean, there are real problems out there that if they continue on the gridlock, I mean, there are a lot of people who are going to be hurting here. So do they come up with a deal at the end? I mean, I had simply assumed that they would come up with a deal, but then they didn't come up with a deal and they went on vacation, which I have to admit took me by surprise. Chris?
Well, I think going into next year, what I'm hearing is that right now it's a disease-driven economy. And at some point, that by the way, the stock market's doing great, S&P's doing well. So everybody looks at it as a short-term thing because it's a disease-driven. It's not driven by long-term forces like the Great Depression or something. But at some point, we're going to need a lot more relief. Next year, probably. I think the error right now on the side of liberalism works. I think printing money works. I don't like the sound of it. I don't believe the new monetary policy that you just print money. But right now, I think you only get hurt on the other side. And fiscal accountability, fiscal responsibility is not going to be a clarion call right now to any politician or any voter. So I think Pelosi pushing for three, ending up with two, it's solid for her. And the way the parties make sense now, all of a sudden, it makes sense to have a relatively conservative party and a liberal party. They can fight with each other and end up somewhere in the middle. That's what, to me, politics has always been. 8 and 6 means 7. It means 7. And then we're better off with that 7 than we would with 8 or 6.
So, Mark, I want to bounce something off you guys that I've been thinking about. You know, we for a lot of the year, we've been talking about, would there be a V-shaped recovery? Would there be a W-shaped recovery? And I saw, and I should give credit to whoever it was who came up with this the other day, said, actually, what we're seeing is a K-shaped recovery, that the well-off are doing okay. They're doing just fine. If you're in the stock market, you're doing okay. And then if you're in the working class, or if you are, dependent on the many elements of the economy, you're dying. But we don't hear those stories. I mean, Mark, I kind of wonder whether or not the narrative is leaving out the real crisis that people are going, hey, man, I have not had a job in 3 months. I don't know where my income is coming from here. And whether or not we're not getting a sense in the political class and the media class, not getting a sense of the number of Americans that are about to fall off a cliff.
It's inevitable, Charlie. And I'm only surprised that it hasn't happened sooner. But, this is the first time that I've really gone out into the country this last week and flown on airplanes, been in hotels, and you just see the impact everywhere. I mean, just for example, in hotels, it's just spooky how few people are working there. But, they don't do room service or clean the rooms anymore. So just think about all the maids who are out of work.
I was thinking of that.
Just, I mean, down the line, when you get out in the country and you say, yeah, I think it's just we've got this sugar high because of the stimulus. But, man, it's going to go off a cliff, in my opinion, at some point.
Well, you know what made me think about this? This is like sort of my random thought process was what happened in Iowa over the weekend, where we had this massive natural disaster, the straight winds that wiped out what like a third of the crops in the entire state of Iowa, and nobody knew about it. Nobody heard about it.
Yeah,
I think I saw it in a newsletter saying this is the biggest natural disaster that you haven't heard about. And the Washington Post did a story about how, this is, we have 100,000 people without power and it's virtually not covered. People wouldn't, be talking about it if somebody hadn't posted an article on Medium. So I do wonder whether or not we're in this era, for whatever reason, where there are a lot of stories that are just not being told or that we're not focusing on because we only focus on certain bright, shiny objects.
Well, just to make that point a little stronger, we always make comments, the casual flippant comment is you're out flipping hamburgers, making $7 or $8 an hour when you should be making 30. But what happens when those $7 or $8 jobs disappear? And I was thinking that all those concessionaires at airports, all those people with those little operations, Orange Julius's, whatever they are, that barely just struggle along, they're gone. And they'd already lost most of those jobs to automation. I mean, you go to the LaGuardia and everything's on a tablet there. I get at the desktop to order a hamburger. All those jobs are gone. CVS jobs, all those minimum wage jobs, usually women working in those places behind the counter, those jobs were gone already. They were already going to automation. You punch out your, whatever you buy at a drugstore now, you just punch it out on your credit card. So those jobs were on their way out. Now they're completely gone. All restaurants, all hotels. My wife worked as a hotel executive for years. All those, you know, cleaning our rooms, those rooms are necessary jobs for people. Often immigrants, that's their first job, maybe their last job, and they're gone. And meanwhile, Amazon and people that are making money online, I think that's where the reason the stock market is so sound is because Amazon, those places are making business like they can't. People are buying everything online now. The UPS and FedEx is delivering to a lot of upper and middle class people every day now. They're delivering every day something in a box. Well, who's making that money? Jeff Bezos and some people in a warehouse, maybe.
Well, there's a lot of people making money. And of course, you know, all the cash that has been, has been injected into the economy. I do wonder how the politics of this plays out, because I sense that the political class doesn't have a sense of urgency because they're looking at the stock market. They're hearing from their donors. They're watching the folks on the media are talking about other things. And so we don't have that sense of pain. Okay, let me switch back to the convention, because one of the big questions, and things move too fast. It's like, you know, as we know, and you know, Chris, you did the Daily Show. By the time you started at what, 7 o'clock, whatever you thought was going to happen at 12 o'clock was already outdated. I mean, that's the kind.
Well, we always got the advantage, guys, Mark, of the first the filings of major newspapers. And so, and it's old school. I'm pretty old school. The Times and the Post, everybody's filed their story. The best reporters in the country filed their stories around 6:30. So I loved it. It was like right out of the old newspaper movies. Break down the front page, start over again. This is going to break this town wide open. And we would have a whole new show at 7 o'clock that started at 6 because of the way the daily papers for the next day were, you know, being filed. And I agree. But I think you said something interesting. It's almost like People magazine, but there's a national interest in Michelle that is broader than politics. And she's a figure of national interest, almost like a royal. And I do think, because everybody knows that if she wanted to be VP, God knows who would have said no to her. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I don't think we have figures like that around in politics like her. So if she gets a charming, thoughtful, heartfelt speech, I mean, it will be on the top of the fold of all the papers tomorrow morning. And again, I'm thinking old school. Who's going to be top of the fold with a nice big picture in color? It's going to be her, Michelle Obama.
So, Mark, is it too soon to get a sense, or do you have a sense of how the Kamala Harris pick is good? The upside, the downsides. The polls would suggest that it's a relatively popular choice, but then I also see that Sarah Palin had a 60% approval rating the week after she was selected. We know how that all turned out. So give me your sense about Biden choosing Kamala Harris.
I think it's been a very strong pick. It seemed like the inevitable one to me. I mean, the three ultimate criteria were that it was going to be a woman. We knew that. I think it had to be a woman of color, just given the issues and the blowback that would have happened had he not picked a black woman. He would have dealt for that with weeks, perhaps, all the way to the election.
Exactly.
And then that it had to be a woman who had experience on the national stage. I mean, to be a candidate in this environment going against Trump, you better be used to the human microwave, because he's going to crank it up to 11. So, and she's the only one that met all three of those criteria. So I think it's a good pick. I think it's a strong pick. I think very little downside. I think he had to row the boat and not rock it, and I think that's what he did.
And she has so many tributaries of support, of sororities, African-American sororities from the HBC, from the historically black colleges. They're all over the country. They're very influential people, very sophisticated. I've been at those meetings. You've got the Caribbean people, the South Asian people. All these groups are going to be organizing. They'll have watch parties. They're going to be so into it. Then you have the meritocratic crowd, the highly educated women, especially from the suburbs, who got a master's degree. They're going to look at her as a sister, someone who's like them, who got themselves educated, made themselves a life. I think she appeals to an awful lot of people. And I don't think, well, you never know about ethnic prejudice where it's going to hurt, but I think she's going to do fine in this country across the board. I think the only people that won't like her are people that already like Trump and are impossible. But yeah. She will be very good on the stage. I think he doesn't have to worry. And by the way, it's about Beau, not about Hunter. This relationship was Beau.
Right.
Beau, somebody told me that when you had a fundraiser for Beau, she would be there. Kamala would be there, which is so interesting. That she was on the, and then she went and hit him hard in that first debate. But I think he's recovered. And Valerie or Jill, whoever didn't like that performance by her, I think was argued over. And he said, I'm going to go with somebody I know, and I know her. So,
you know, I agree with everything you're saying there. In fact, I'm slightly embarrassed to say this because this is what punditry has become, is watching somebody else on cable television saying something. I want to invent the phrase ring light punditry. Probably only Mark McKinnon knows what I'm talking about. You know,
I've been using it this morning at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Me too. No, these are all of our punditry is from home with Skype, but the really the cool kids go out and they invest in the ring light.
The ring lighters,
because it really makes you look better. Everybody looks like shit otherwise on Skype, but the ring light makes you look pretty good. But anyway, I was watching somebody from here from Milwaukee, one of the activists from the Central City. And this was a big problem for Hillary Clinton 4 years ago when African Americans went, no, we're not going to turn out for you. We're not going to turn out for you in the numbers we turned out for Barack Obama. You didn't even bother to show up. You didn't even bother to ask us. So she got 40,000 fewer votes in Milwaukee than Barack Obama. And you could just tell, though, from the reaction that the selection of Kamala Harris has done a lot to make the African-American community pay attention, more enthusiastic. But I will also tell you, going back to Chris's earlier point, this pushback, this backlash to the what it looks like the attempts to screw around with the voting, the voter suppression, this has really gotten people's attention. So I do think. But on Kamala Harris, I thought one of the most interesting things in the first 48 hours after her nomination was she was kind of a Rorschach test for, you know, our politics, how people were going to react to her. And the fact that Donald Trump could not resist playing the race card for 48 hours was interesting. If you basically just threw her out as bait, let's see if Donald Trump will go back to birtherism or something like that. It was like he went right for it. And I know I share your sense, Chris, about his, you know, his reptilian cunning, but this was one where, you know, no, really, do you really want to go there? Do you really want to, you know, jump on this that you can't? You
it's
know,
so bad because
it
every
is so bad.
We are so acculturated now to having South Asians in our popular culture. First of all, just take her mother. Every sitcom has, it seems to be, someone in the office from South Asian ancestry. It's just part of us now, and it happened rapidly. But, you know, I'm second generation. My grandmother's from Northern Ireland. My grandfather's from England. You know, the idea that a first generation, like my parents were, suspect citizens. No, there's the 14th Amendment if you don't have anything else going for you. If you're born here, you're a citizen here. And the idea that there's some question because her parents were Caribbean and South Asian. Why? How can he even say that? What has that got to do with whether?
It's the birthright citizen.
Yeah, he's saying anchor baby. So, what's an anchor baby if being born here isn't enough?
Well, he and Stephen Miller sitting in a room together thinking, this is clever. This is great. See, we're going to plant this thing. Black woman, not really an American. We only question people's Americanism, apparently, if they're non-white. I mean, this is so obvious. So, Mark, I mean, I just don't see how this works for him. That other tweet about, you know, suburban housewives should know that I'm going to protect your suburbs from, you know, those poor people who are a plan run by Cory Booker. Cory Booker, who, by the way, you know, I wouldn't mind having Cory Booker as my neighbor. I mean, really? I mean, Cory Booker is like one of the most unthreatening human beings alive. But it felt like he was just going through, like, you know, possible scary black men.
Yeah,
I think that, again, I think that's going to blow back incredibly. I mean, speaking of Cory Booker, we had him on our show last night. And to your point, I mean, he is, if you're going to go after somebody, Cory Booker is the most optimistic, friendly human being on the planet. And just as an expression of that, right in the middle of our interview, he interrupted it. And we did the interview in his garage, by the way, and it was raining. So it was very funky. But there was a neighbor that he saw across the way. He said, "Oh, hey, Joey," or whatever, "I meant to get you some masks." And he runs upstairs, get a bag of masks, throws it over the fence to this guy waiting. So, you know, he was like doing this community service right in the middle of our interview. So, I mean, it's just notion of the others and the scary, you know, they're coming out of suburbs. And by the way, I think, you know, calling people suburban housewives doesn't get him any votes either.
Okay. Yeah, so, you know what I think? I just discovered the other day that the name Willie Horton, of course, is the example supreme of this whole thing of race baiting. But back in the 88 campaign, Willie Horton, you know what his name was? He's a bad guy, of course, a killer, rapist, awful person, and he's in jail forever. But do you know what his name first name was? William. That's what he went by his whole life. Willie was a creation of the admin.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Wow. Isn't that something? They thought they had to make sure that he was definitely seen as black. So let's call him Willie. Yeah. Oh, it was when I came across it, I said, "This is unbelievable, Willie." Yeah.
All right. So since we're kicking off our convention coverage, even though there's sort of a non-convention here in Milwaukee, and by the way, I remember you have to understand how weird it is being here in Milwaukee and not having this convention because the amount of money people spent here, and you know the plans and all of the stuff that goes through. I will tell you though that part of me thinks that the Democrats might have dodged a bullet here, which is that this convention will have no controversy. There will be no floor fights. There will be nobody who will be a distraction, right? There will be no street protests. Milwaukee will not be turned into an armed fortress with 1,000 cops and everything. Having seen Cleveland 4 years ago, it didn't strike me as completely good news that they were descending upon my hometown. But since we're kicking off our convention coverage, you guys are convention veterans. So your favorite convention, your favorite convention story, Chris Matthews.
Well, I could do positive Republican Democrat real quickly. I thought George Herbert Walker Bush's speech, his speech that Peggy Noonan wrote in New Orleans in 88 was fantastic. And it played on his weakness, which was he's not that articulate. And remember the vision thing and things like that. He didn't know how to talk for the big audience.
Yeah.
And she gave him a speech that got me. I'm up way up in the cheap seats in the Superdome, and I'm misty-eyed because here's a guy standing before the United States saying, "I'm not too articulate. I'm an awkward guy, but I care about my country." It got to me.
That was a great speech.
And I forget the read my lips nonsense. That got him into trouble. But the other one that got to me was sitting at Chapel Hill in grad school watching the 68 convention in Chicago, the one I didn't get to go, and not missing a gavel pound. I watched every moment of that, the people getting beat up, everything. And I remember Walter Cronkite, and he has never had his match, saying to us at night when we finally closed down the gavel to gavel around 10:30 at night, he said, "Get some sleep. We'll be back here in the morning." And it was like we were all together. And I thought that was, there was never been a Cronkite again, of course, but he made us feel like this country was together around the couch watching this thing. And that really was my favorite convention, I think, 68, because of that, because of Cronkite, you know.
Okay, Mark McKinnon.
I just had two anecdotes that are kind of fun. One is the 88 convention, which I covered as a reporter. And it was the 80 convention that I covered in New York. And it was so exciting as a young reporter to be covering a convention. So I was incredibly full of myself, thought I was really important to be this young guy running around covering the convention. And I had to be somewhere and I kind of got lost and I was running around. It was at Madison Square Garden and I came out a door and outside the door were these, you know, this classic mounted police, New York cops on horses, you know, with the aviator sunglasses, big dudes. And I was really frustrated. And there were some sawhorses there. And I'm like, I need to be somewhere. I've got to be, you know, I'm an important reporter. I got a job to do. And they look down at me and the biggest of them all, like, swings down off the horse, moves the sawhorse about a foot so I can walk through. And as I walk through, he looks down at me, goes, "Another tough one solved."
Hey, Charlie, I got to throw one in here because okay, my brilliant Kathleen, my wife, just came up with the idea. Back in 04, at that Boston convention, the keynoter was Barack Obama. And when he gave that speech and when he talked about only in this country is my story possible,
yeah,
it got to me. Because that was the best statement of my notion of American exceptionalism. With a guy named Barack Hussein Obama, I didn't know it was Hussein at the time, could make it as far as he got. Nowhere else in the world can you do that. That, to me, was America. And I said afterwards, you've just heard the first African-American president. And I think on the air, I was glad I did. And I think they do showcase Bill Clinton to his disadvantage in 88 when he gave that stem winder that never ended. But he got past that. And it did show Mario Cuomo in his glory forever with his speech of the two cities. And Jesse, yeah. I want to go back to Jesse because Jesse doesn't get enough credit for his oratory, but he talked about the, I think, African-American woman who works as an attendant, a low-paid minimum wage person working in a hospital. But when her time comes to need a bed, she couldn't afford one. Well, that got to the heartstrings, that one. And I think there are those moments. Let's hope we have some of those moments because I love oratory. I'm sure you and Mark do too. In the end, that's the one thing that sustains politics. People who say something really grand and important, and we listen to it.
Can I just go to my second favorite one, Charlie?
Yeah, please.
Well, because Chris has a perfect segue. Of course, my favorite one is 2000 when I was working for George W. Bush, and I was with him before his speech, and I was helping him get ready and, you know, trying to pick out the right cufflinks and tie and all that. And then I rode with him from there to the convention. I think really the reason that he wanted me to ride with him is I don't talk much, and he really just wanted to get in the zone and be kind of, you know, get his head together. And so I wasn't like rattling him with a bunch of questions. I just shut up and I was listening. And as I was sitting there and the cars were driving over, suddenly I hear somebody whistling, "Go Tell It on the Mountain." And I think it's the radio, right? I think, well, yeah, this is really weird. It's "Go Tell It on the Mountain." And I turn and it's George W. Bush is whistling, "Go Tell It on the Mountain." And then I couldn't help myself. I said, "Governor, this is like the most dramatic, you know, moment of your life to date. You got to be a bundle of nerves and you're whistling, 'Go Tell It on the Mountain.' What's with that?" And he turned to me and said, "Mark, I just got to tell you, I've never felt calmer in my life because, you know, a lot of people have a perception about who I am and a lot of it's wrong. And this is my opportunity to unvarnish, tell it in my own words, show my heart, show why I believe in compassionate conservatism. And if they don't like me, that's okay, because tonight they'll hear my heart and my soul." And he did it. And it was a really great speech.
That is a great story. So I have two. I was going to lead with one from 68, but since we're talking, Chris, I'm flashing back to, I think, 2 o'clock in the morning after Trump's acceptance speech, which was, of course, one of the, you know, more depressing moments of my life. And for whatever reason, because all rational people had either better parties to go to or knew they needed to get to bed, I ended up being on your panel of your show. Okay.
Yeah.
And it was me. You won't remember this. It was me, and sitting next to me was Kellyanne Conway, and sitting a couple down was Ann Coulter. So that's a
menagerie of happiness there.
I know, it's like it's 2 in the morning and there I'm sitting there with Chris Matthews, Ann Coulter and Kellyanne Conway. That should be like a, you know, walk into a bar story. And I just remember Kellyanne leaning over and saying, so what if Mr. Trump called you? Would you take the call? And I said, of course I would take the call, but it wouldn't make any difference. And then Ann Coulter was Ann Coulter. But my favorite story was when I was 13 years old. It's the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago. It had been a complete shit show. You know, the police riot. I won't say that I was tear gassed, but I got enough of a whiff that I know what it smells like and what it does to your eyes. And I was a page to the delegation. And I became fixated on the final night of the convention in getting a souvenir. And the Wisconsin delegation, of course, had been very, very rowdy and very central to a lot of what was going on there. And I figured, I'm going to get that banner. You know, the banner that people, you know, hold up and down, you know, the cardboard banner.
Yeah.
And so as it was breaking down, I ran across the floor, grabbed the Wisconsin banner and stole it, took it home. And for years, that thing sat in my garage. I got it all the way home. It was cardboard, had these cardboard letters, all the letters on three sides, you know, the three cornered thing. And one by one, the letters, you know, fell off, and over time the thing fell apart. And I will tell you, gentlemen, I deeply regret the carelessness of my youth now, because I would love to have that thing.
Oh, wouldn't that be a great memento to still have? That's a great story, Charlie.
It would be. Gentlemen, thank you so much for kicking off our special podcast convention coverage. This has been a blast. Mark McKinnon and the legendary Chris Matthews, thank you for coming on today. And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be doing this all week. There's 78 days to go before the election.